It's the combination of wanting to make sure that we maintain our civil liberties, but that we also keep up with the evolving threat.
Alaska's senators vote for NSA reforms. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a change of heart for the homeless shelter in Juneau.
When I first heard about the concept, I thought this is such a ridiculous idea. I guess it would never work.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Raven Alaska, providing business travel needs in over 100 communities across the state. Find more at flyraven.com.
The U.S. Senate today voted to limit the NSA's collection of bulk phone data. Both Alaska senators voted for the reforms called the USA Freedom Act. Senator Lisa Murkowski was an early sponsor and last session was one of the few Republicans who voted to advance the bill. Senator Dan Sullivan says he became convinced the bill was a good revision to the controversial parts of the 2001 Patriot Act.
I think that this reform dramatically enhances civil liberties and the protection of privacy, which is why I voted for it.
Late last month, Sullivan voted for a short-term extension of the Patriot Act, which failed. He says he didn't want the less controversial programs to go dark during the debate. Sullivan says surveillance and data collection programs require a balance, and he thinks more reforms may be needed in the future.
It's the combination of wanting to make sure that we maintain our civil liberties, but that we also keep up with the evolving threat. And we don't know what the evolving threat is going to be 3 months from now or 6 months from now.
The bill passed with 67 votes. Among the 32 no votes were presidential candidates Rand Paul and Bernie Sanders, who felt the reform bill didn't go far enough to protect civil liberties. Also voting no were defense hawks like Republican Senators John McCain and Mitch McConnell, who support the NSA surveillance programs. The bill already passed the House, where it had the vote of Alaska Congressman Don Young. All state ferries will stop sailing by early July if the legislature fails to reach a budget deal. The Alaska Marine Highway System's plans are among dozens of state service cuts announced yesterday by the Walker administration. Ferry spokesman Jeremy Woodrow says the 11 ships in the fleet will head to their home ports as close to July 1st as possible.
We can't play guessing games that there will be a fully funded budget at some point, and so we have to play it safe and have the ships be in interlayup status in July.
Some ferries will stop sailing in the final days of June, while others will tie up a few days later. Woodrow says a skeleton crew will remain with each ship to keep it ready to return to service. One ferry, the Taku, was already scheduled to be tied up for July and August as part of budget cuts. The ferry system serves 35 port communities. Only 5 are on the mainland road system. About 800 Alaska court system employees will be forced to take 2 days of unpaid leave around the holidays, a result of state budget cuts. Except for emergency business, the court system will be closed the day after Thanksgiving, Friday, November 27th, and Christmas Eve, a Thursday, says spokeswoman Mara Rabinowitz. They're typically light work days. Court employees aren't affected by the executive branch layoff notices mailed on Monday. Scientists are looking at how a warmer North Pacific Ocean could affect weather and climate this year. There could also be significant impacts to marine life, including species that form the basis for Alaska's commercial fisheries. KTOO's Matt Miller has more from Juneau.
A conference at California Scripps Institution of Oceanography in May featured scientists in fields ranging from avian biology to Arctic climatology. They tried to determine the potential impacts of a giant mass of warm ocean water that currently stretches from the Gulf of Alaska down to Baja California. Temperatures have increased more than 2 degrees Celsius since the fall of 2013.
Can 2 degrees C really affect weather and marine life? I know. It doesn't seem like very much. It seems like, oh, that's not such a big deal.
Molly McCammon is with the Alaska Ocean Observing System, an observing and data gathering organization based in Anchorage, and she helped organize the Alaska contingent that participated in that California conference.
But for species that live in the ocean, it's a big deal. 1 degree C is a big deal for things that live in the ocean. So, yes, it can have a big impact.
Nicknamed the blob, the mass of warm ocean water may be a factor in Alaska's recent mild winters, dry conditions along the West Coast, and extreme cold conditions in the Great Lakes region last winter. It's not the same as El Niño, which has its origins in the equatorial region, and it's not clear if the blob is related to Pacific Decadal Oscillation, a longer-term cycle of ocean climate variability. Its formation may have been generated by a lingering high-pressure system over the Northeast Pacific that diverted winds and passing storm systems. As a result, the ocean surface did not have the chance to cool off as usual.
I think the consensus was that, yes, this is an unusual warming event. It's above and beyond just the warming that's happening as a result of global warming. There also seems to be an El Niño forming right now as well, but they think that's separate, but it could be merging, exacerbating this unusual warming event. So there's a lot of unknowns.
The relationship between the ocean and atmosphere is complex, and the interactions are rarely linear or sequential. Ocean surface temperatures, surface and subsurface currents, atmospheric pressure, winds, temperature, precipitation, and geography may all be linked in some way, and how each influences another could vary significantly.
That's actually what we're trying to figure out at the moment, what or how things might be linked to the blob.
Peter Benyennek was one of the Alaska scientists who attended the conference. He's a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Alaska Fairbanks International Arctic Research Center.
Because normally there are linkages to what goes on in the North Pacific, and especially the equatorial Pacific, sea surface temperatures. Like if there's an El Niño going on in the equatorial Pacific, then we'll tend to get, for instance, warmer than normal sometimes winters in Alaska.
Bienek expects the higher ocean temperatures will persist for the rest of the year. The longer view, however, is difficult to predict. Scientists believe the layer of warm surface water extends to a depth of 100 meters. The boundary acts as a barrier and can hinder up and down movement of phytoplankton through the water column. The tiny, light-sensitive marine organisms form the base of the ocean food chain. Jamal Moss says the prognosis is good so far for juvenile Alaska salmon now heading out to the open ocean. This year's juvenile pinks, for example, are the biggest ever and have the largest lipid or fat reserves.
So big fish that have lots of energy tend to survive better. So right now, all signs are pointing to good conditions for at least the Alaska stocks.
Moss is a fisheries research biologist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Auk Bay, who specializes in juvenile salmon and juvenile marine fish ecology. At the recent conference at Scripps, Moss says they figured
this might be a boon for fish. Might actually help them, at least in the short term, because it appears that the zooplankton that juvenile fish are eating is abundant, as well as high in energy and fat. Even though there are a whole new suite of predators, host of predators that are in these waters that are potentially preying upon them as well, it seems like they're going to do well.
Unusual marine sightings in high latitudes include blue and thresher sharks, pomfret, and sunfish. Those are species that usually congregate in warmer waters. Moss says scientists have also detected an increase in juvenile sablefish or black cod offshore of Alaska, but they don't know yet whether it's related to the blob or if it's just a coincidence. As for the West Coast, Moss says it may be a mixed bag of conditions for species in warmer water. Alaska Ocean Observing System's Molly McCammon says scientists are planning research for the summer to determine the impacts on species and find out how and why the blob has moved and stretched out along the West Coast. A follow-up conference to compare notes is tentatively planned for late fall. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, chamber music on the bus, an urban conflux comes to Anchorage.
We're trying to create a new event in the city of Anchorage where people need to understand it's a fun, great city.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The state is being criticized for finding hundreds of seniors ineligible for a Medicaid waiver program that pays the cost of their housing and nursing care. The director of Senior and Disability Services defended the denials in a story we aired yesterday. Today, we'll look at an apparent gap between the state's disability services and the people who need them. KBBI's Quentin Chandler has more.
In the last 5 years, there has been a rise in the number of people denied the Medicaid waiver after reassessment. Dwayne Mays, Director of Senior and Disabilities Services, or SDS, says the department wasn't able to conduct its annual evaluations of waiver recipients' eligibility up until several years ago because of a series of lawsuits.
So for literally a period of 7 to 8 years, we were unable to remove anybody that no longer met level of care from our waiver system.
Mays says the lawsuits were settled about 3 years ago, and that made it possible to remove people from the program. In the last 5 years, the department has carried out 8,253 reassessments for its waiver recipients in South Central Alaska. 30% received denials. At Main Street Assisted Living in Homer, the rate of denials is much higher. More than half of the residents could lose their waivers next year. Resident Mary Ann Frederick received one of the denials, and she disapproves of the way her assessment was carried out.
When they came and assessed me, the woman who did the marking paid absolutely no attention to any mental or behavioral issues. You know, she entirely skipped like a whole half of the form.
Holly Chips has been a certified nursing assistant for 30 years. She's worked at Main Street Assisted Living for the past 2 years.
It is a very vague list, and vagueness connotates insincerity. To ask a resident, can you take a spoon, put it in your bowl, and feed yourself, is not a fair depiction. Can they go to the store? Can they cook their own meal? Can they determine what is good food and bad food, prepare it, and then feed themselves? No, they can't.
Mays, with the state, says the face-to-face interview isn't the only research the state conducts to determine a person's eligibility. They check the questionnaire against medical records, and the ultimate decision is reviewed by a third-party contractor. And lastly, applicants are given a chance to appeal a denial. Still, Chips is certain not a single one of her residents looking at losing their waiver can live by themselves. So, for now, people like Frederick have a couple of options. They can fight the system through appeals, or if that doesn't work, Mays says the department has other services.
There's general relief, there's personal care attendant services. I mean, we expend 100 plus million in funding for personal care attendant services. We also have about 27 million in grant services, grant dollars. Half of that being senior grants.
But these fallbacks might not be enough. Ruth Babcock, owner of Main Street Assisted Living, says general relief is a temporary aid.
General relief was originally set up to deal with people who did not have any resources and were younger and maybe were injured, had a health issue, needed a place to get well for a few months, maybe.
The grant services are designed to help people before their health becomes so poor that they need round-the-clock care. And personal care assistance doesn't guarantee all the services that come with the waiver. Plus, it is only available to people living in their own home. Mays says he's heard the concerns that their continuum of care is not comprehensive enough. Partly for that reason, SDS is trying to bring two new waiver options online, one of which will serve seniors who aren't eligible for nursing home level of care. But it could take 2 years for those tools to come online. They won't be around to help Marianne Frederick or Babcock's 8 other residents who could lose the waiver in the next year. Frederick still has a ray of hope. Her lawyer found a problem in the paperwork she received from SDS, so she's clinging to that. In Homer, I'm Quentin Chandler.
Juneau will become the third city in Alaska to offer permanent supportive housing to the high-risk chronically homeless. Those are the people who have been on the streets the longest and may suffer from addiction or mental health issues. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more on the new initiative that got a big boost last week.
The Glory Hole offers 3 meals a day and connects the homeless with services to look for work or find housing. Up to 43 people can sleep in the shelter's beds. But a deal breaker to staying overnight.
Just blow a full breath into it, kind of, sort of slower.
What did I blow?
Zeros.
You have to pass a breathalyzer with a blood alcohol level of 0.10. Trevor Keller is the outreach coordinator and housing specialist at the shelter. He says he doesn't like telling people they can't stay.
You know, it can be a bummer to kick folks out, especially in the winter. Asking them to leave when it's really cold is just so hard to do, but we just try and hold a line of, this is what we are, this is who we serve, you know, this is our sobriety requirements.
Juneau is estimated to have nearly 600 homeless. 40 of those are considered high risk, so the hardest to house. But for some in that population, that's about to change. The Glory Hole just received a grant from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation to build a Housing First project. Maria Lovashuk, the executive director, says before you can address substance abuse or mental illness,
you need to put the person in housing. So you need to give no strings attached housing in order for the person to stabilize.
The grant includes $3 million in capital funding, as well as $1.2 million for operational costs for the next 3 years. Tlingit-Haida Regional Housing Authority is contributing land located in Lemon Creek, where the project will be built. Lovashuk says there were a lot of obstacles to overcome to get the 32-bed Housing First facility to this point. One of them was her initial aversion to the idea.
When I first heard about the concept, I thought this is such a ridiculous idea. I guess it would never work, and I philosophically am actually opposed to it.
She says at the Glory Hole, the breathalyzer policy works really well.
And so I just thought that it's impossible to have 32 people who consume substances as we wish, live under the same roof and have it not turn out totally horrible.
She also thought it could be enabling. So Lovashuk visited some of the Housing First models in Seattle to find out for herself.
It really took seeing how it works to realize that, you know, when somebody is in constant crisis and has been on the street for 12 years, you can't just expect them to go to rehab. A lot of these folks have gone to rehab many, many, many times, and they're trying.
After that, Lovashuk noticed patterns of behavior around the Glory Hole. For instance, a sober guest fresh out of rehab would say,
you know, I'm so excited, I'm not going to drink anymore.
Then the inevitable stress of living in a shelter would cause them to relapse.
Oh, this person moved my stuff, my phone got stolen, you know, just seeing it kind of mounting and mounting and mounting, and then seeing this excitement about having a good life after rehab disappear, and then seeing them initially relapse, and then seeing that it was really heartbreaking.
Lovashuk takes me outside to see if we can find some of the people who could be helped by the Housing First project. Up the metal stairs behind the shelter, we find an alcove with several men in sleeping bags lying on the ground.
Yeah, I don't know. I think we're going to wake them up.
Okay.
Yeah.
Rainforest Recovery Center emergency vehicles patrol downtown Juneau several times a day looking for chronic inebriates. The program has a room where people can sleep off their intoxication. But the service can be costly. In a 2-month span, one client racked up over $33,000 in expenses that included trips to the ER. Lovashuk hopes the Housing First building will cut down these costs. The units will be more like apartments. Everyone will have their own.
So it's definitely not going to be a shelter. Nobody has to have annoying roommates. It will be people's own little home.
The Juneau Housing First Collaborative is looking for additional funding for the $7 million project, but Lovashuk says they would like to start breaking ground this summer. Once built, it will be funded by a combination of grants, donations, and residents paying a small portion for what they'll call home. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Fort Yukon recently began operating a solar electric project. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the system is testing integration of the energy source into the power grid of an isolated northern community.
The Regional Tanana Chiefs Conference and local Native Village Corporation are cooperating on the Fort Yukon Solar Project, which went live last month. TCC Rural Energy Coordinator Dave Messier helped locals set up the system.
The solar array is an 18 kW fixed-axis solar array. It's got 72 250-watt Canadian solar panels that are installed in the tribal halls, on the roof of the tribal hall.
Like most rural Alaska villages, Fort Yukon's power comes from generators fueled with expensive shipped-in diesel. And Messier says the solar project is aimed at reducing that dependence.
To save the tribal council money on their electric bills, and also to kind of bring solar into the Yukon Flats, into Fort Yukon. It's 8 miles north of the Arctic Circle, and so this is kind of proof of concept.
During the sunny part of the year, Messier expects the panels to produce more power than the tribal hall uses each month.
They won't have a power bill. In other words, they'll be sending out onto the grid more electricity than they're consuming for 6 months of the year.
Messier calculates that the electricity produced from the solar array could offset 1,300 gallons of diesel-generated power annually, but cautions that adding a new energy source in the wrong proportion can result in an unbalanced load that reduces generator efficiency.
And so we're not saying that this is going to be the perfect project, but we're definitely hoping to learn from it and hoping that the parties will be able to work together moving forward to make a project that does reduce fuel consumption and that is sustainable for the community.
The solar project is combined with new LED lights and weatherization upgrades at the tribal hall, a total package that cost about $250,000 and was covered 50-50 by the tribe and a federal grant. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Over the weekend, Anchorage experienced an urban conflux. If you're not familiar with the term, don't worry. It's made up. A group of community members worked with cultural institutions and the bus system to engineer a unique project, throw a surprise party for the city. And as KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports, it worked.
Stepping onto the 45 bus at noon Saturday by the Alaska Native Medical Center campus, it's a strange scene. Aside from scattered passengers, there's a jubilant-looking man in a green shirt handing out cards, and at the back of the bus, a group of chamber musicians. As the bus winds north past the university area, the lone percussionist uses the relative quiet between stops to explain why they're there.
You like what you just heard? Take a little bit of time out of your Saturday afternoon and join us downtown at Town Square by the Performing Arts Center. A lot of fun, a lot of different music. We give you a return ticket on the bus so you can resume your afternoon after you're done with us downtown. So come and join us.
5:30, which stood for the date, May 30th, I learned, is the working title for the city's first urban conflux, an invented term for a new experimental event using music to change people's behavior across the city. As I rode the 45, there were a handful of other buses making their way downtown, each with its own acoustic interventions. The guy in the green shirt is one of the 5:30 volunteers and greeted every single person who came aboard during the 50-minute ride.
My name is Sasha Sagan, and we're trying to create new event in city of Anchorage where people need to understand it's a fun, great city.
16-year-old Kristen didn't seem moved on that grand of a scale. However, she was amused to hear chamber music for the first time on a bus she rides a lot.
There's more entertainment, so it's not boring.
Kristen got off around Airport Heights, and the bus stayed pretty sparse until passengers started piling in around Mountain View. Some people were indifferent, a few looked annoyed by the noise and lack of seating options, and others, like George Shigunaruk, danced along in delight.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
What do you think?
I think it's good. I like it.
Have you, do you ride the 45 a lot?
Every day.
Shugunaruk says this line, which picks up passengers in some tough neighborhoods, generally has an ordinary edge to it. But today, the ride's been so fun, he decides to change up his plans and see what's in store at the park.
Oh, yeah, I just think I'll go down and listen to him.
The ride hits a strange juxtaposition, crawling past a soup kitchen and homeless shelter on 3rd Avenue, with up-tempo violin trills inside and clusters of people sleeping in the grassy shoulders of the road just a few feet beyond. For 11-year-old Gia, sitting with the musicians, the event itself tilts towards social justice.
I think it's crazy, but it's nice that they're doing it so they share it with the people.
How come?
Some people don't get to see people play instruments all the time, and it's nice for them to see that.
Alas, Gia didn't have her violin, so she couldn't join in herself.
Well, I had a sleepover with my uncle who's playing, and I didn't bring it. I don't know why.
The bus clears out at the transit center, and a number of passengers eventually float across the street to the park. The plaza is filled with stilt walkers, bicyclists, hula hoopers, musicians, and many surprised-looking civilians wandering through. Several people pound at a large wooden marimba accompanying the Anchorage Symphony Orchestra. The event came together with help from major sponsors like the Rasmussen and Atwood Foundations, as well as a small army of volunteers. But organizers are delighted by the idea that there's not really any way to gauge the event's success. Evidence, they say, is that a downtown park was filled with sounds and smiles on a beautiful Saturday. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld, Jeremy Shea, Elizabeth Jenkins, and Matt Miller in Juneau, Quentin Chandler in Homer, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Garrison Keillor, one of the most beloved radio hosts and acclaimed humorists, is coming to the Alaska State Fair with his America the Beautiful tour on Sunday, August 30th at 3 p.m. This 2.5-hour show will feature Prairie Home Companion classics with piano master Richard Dworsky, sound effects man Fred Newman, and other special guests. Tickets at alaskastatefair.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.